definitely on my top 10 list of 2021, A View of Phenomenal Nature by Cassandra Jenkins. And from that, we heard the first single that was released from the album, Michelangelo, came out, April, I think, roughly this year. Just an amazing, amazing record indeed. It has been a pleasure joining you here today on my first show here on CKUT, and hopefully you enjoyed the show. I will tell you once again that you are tuned to CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and online at ckut.ca. This is Jeffrey Davison signing off. Hope to see you again.
What's the matter? Is everything all right? That's okay. I've got just the right thing for you. CKUT 90.3 FM.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Friday edition of CKUT's Community News Program, Off the Hour. Today is Friday, October 29th. My name is Brian Jefferson, and I will be your host today. CKUT broadcasts from the unceded traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg and the Kanyenkehaga, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Stay tuned, we'll be right back.
Cauliflower.
Confusion. Creation.
Pickle. K for
kitten.
Camp.
See, wait. Sandroof. See, you. Unbearable.
U is for underground.
Oh, yeah.
Umbrella.
T. Trite.
Tremendous.
Torment.
Tire.
C. K.
I can't think of a U one.
T. T.
F is for famous.
Fun. Fumble. M is for Montreal.
First, news. The province continues to ease COVID-19 related health restrictions. Bars and restaurants will be allowed to reopen to full capacity on November 1st for the first time since the start of the pandemic. New guidelines reduce the required space between customers from 2 meters to 1 meter. Bars and restaurants will also be allowed to remain open until 3 a.m. Some restrictions will remain in place with a cap on the number of people to a table and formal ban on indoor dancing. And the global environmental group Extinction Rebellion has covered two billboards on Autoroute 40 with their own messaging, denouncing the Royal Bank of Canada's fossil fuel investments. The Royal Bank is the world's fifth largest financier of fossil fuel projects and has poured $208 billion into the industry since the 2016 Paris Climate Accord. And Montrealers are continuing to mourn the loss of 16-year-old Janai Dopwell Bailey. He was killed in front of his school in Côte-des-Neiges earlier this month by another teen his age. A suspect has been charged in his death. Dopwell Bailey was honored at a vigil last week and remembered as a persistent student, musician, and gentle friend. A GoFundMe campaign has now raised more than $19,000 for his funeral expenses. This is CKUT 90.3 FM.
There's a lot going on in the world today. See how it affects Montreal's Black and Caribbean community. Read the Community Contact. News, features, opinions, music reviews, cultural events, and so much more. Our voices, our perspectives, our community. published every 2 weeks. Pick it up at your favorite community spot or visit us online at our new and dynamic website, mtlcommunitycontact.com. Easy to navigate and lots to enjoy. Archived issues also on the site and available on the web. That's mtlcommunitycontact.com. Stay in contact.
Are you a tenant in Montreal? Do you have questions about your rights? Your local housing committee can help. To find the housing committee for your neighborhood or for more resources, go to www.rclalq.qc.ca.
Welcome back to CKUT's Friday Off the Hour. The time is just after 5 p.m. My name is Brian Jefferson. Montreal Centre for Gender Advocacy held a press conference on Tuesday in response to the provincial tabling of Bill 2. The bill proposes changes to the so-called family law and changes to civil matters like birth certificates, definitions of family, and identification cards. Civil family law reforms have been ongoing for years. In winter 2021, the center won a decades-long challenge to change parts of the civil code. We talked to the center about that win in February. Bill 2 now has new proposals that the center considers to be a direct and purposeful misapplication of the judgment that was passed down earlier this year. If passed, it makes it necessary for people to disclose their sex and gender markers on their IDs and necessitates surgery for people to legally change their ID markers. Trans and intersex people say this could put them at an even more risk by possibly outing them, among other things. We're going to re-listen to that February discussion where the center breaks down their original case as its judgments are now being questioned. We'll be back with you at the top of the hour to give you Montreal-based news that you can use. So stay with us.
University Group has helped bring a lawsuit to a Quebec Superior Court to change parts of the provincial civil code. After a six-year process, they won. Jada Joseph with Concordia University's Center for Gender Advocacy explains what that means for people like trans, non-binary, or intersex Quebecois.
Jada Joseph is the peer support training and drop-in coordinator at the Center for Gender Advocacy. What were some of the discussions that the center heard before this lawsuit came around in 2014?
We originally had filed a lawsuit against the Attorney General in 2014. And the lawsuit that we brought forth sought to invalidate 11 articles of the Quebec Civil Code, specifically articles 59, 62, 71, 93, 111, 115, 116, 124, 126, 132, and 146 of the Quebec Civil Code. And what we were arguing is that these particular codes intersectionally, as they, of course, impact individuals at multiple levels and at different intersections, it violates the rights, integrity, safety, freedom, dignity, as well as the privacy granted by the Quebec Charter of Rights, as well as the Canadian Charter of Freedoms and Rights of trans, non-binary, and intersex people living in Quebec. Before the lawsuit actually came about, it was launched by Gabrielle Bouchard, who was our trans rights educator and advocate at that time. And she was, although also doing education work about trans awareness, she was also doing social work as well, in which she would assist individuals with name and sex designation change. And by virtue of doing this, she, and through her own lived experiences, of course, has witnessed the different barriers that trans folks navigated while trying to acquire name and or sex designation changes. And not only just the process of acquiring such, but also to how having access to these different changes intertwines with the lived experiences and the different ways people navigate their lives. So through housing and education settings and workspaces, this one macro level barrier definitely has interconnected impacts on people's lived experiences. So by virtue of that, you know, she acquired information to then present to our co-plaintiffs, as well as the two lawyers who also assisted us in this court case. And that's pretty much what led to this lawsuit.
Can you explain specific things that were being challenged?
So we had different aspects of the code that we wanted to change. For starters, we wanted for trans migrants to be able to change their name and sex designation, as currently only Canadian citizens who have been living in Quebec for over a year have the possibility of changing their name and sex designations in Quebec. So that was one. The other aspect that we wanted to change was for, with regards to sex designation options, only male or female is currently the only options available. And we also wanted to expand that so that it isn't only male or female, so that we can, you know, respect and honor the fact that non-binary people are living and have been living for years. And thirdly, we also wanted to allow trans parents the possibility of changing their parental role from mother, father, or as well as parent. This was something that was really important, as, you know, this not only reflects and honors the realities of trans families and, like, you know, really acknowledges what these families look like by allowing for this. We also wanted to, like, by virtue of doing this, it allows for and guarantees privacy as well. And another aspect of the code that we wanted to remove was for trans youth to not have to receive medical evaluations by different mental health practitioners in order to obtain a name and or sex designation change, as well as removing parental veto, which allows parents to object their child's application for a name and or sex designation. Another part of the civil code that we wanted to remove as well is the requirement for sex designation at birth. That's a common thing that is practiced in North American societies and has been pushed by the West. And this was something we especially wanted to do while thinking about intersex children who forcefully undergo surgeries in order to uphold like Western science needs of this two-sex system. So yeah, those are some of the articles that we wanted to strike down.
How does Quebec's civil code compare to the code of other provinces?
I don't have extensive knowledge, so I'm going to briefly talk about like what I just simply know, like one point. This is not an area that I'm expert in, but a really key piece is related to trans migrants. Quebec is one of the only provinces in Canada in which Canadian citizenship is required. If we look at other provinces such as Ontario, Canadian citizenship is not required. People are often required to have been living in the province for a period of 3 months to a year in which they're able to change their name and sex designation. So clearly, we see here that Quebec has a definite xenophobic and transphobic issue here.
Why is this not a federal issue? And how do those jurisdictions overlap?
Yeah, so I can talk about this in the context of, let's say, for trans migrants. So for people who have permanent residency on their PR cards and PR documents, it is possible to change your name and sex designation. However, you have to receive the approval through the province. So it's often provincially it's the province on a provincial level in which people can access changing one's name and sex designation. And once that is completed, you can then do so on your PR document, which is under federal level. It's a federal provision, right? So it's the federal government that is responsible for that. So that's one example. And in the context of, for instance, birth certificates, it is under provincial level. This is the case for so many different things, like financially, like finances, social and whatnot. Often, you know, the federal government provides like a basic guideline. So for instance, such as the Canadian Charter of Rights, right? That is a basic guideline that all provinces try to live up to, and thus they then develop their own accordingly that they apply within their own province. However, provincial provinces often are awarded the responsibility of delegation. So pretty much the materialized aspects of people's lives, such as birth certificates and things of that matter, is under provincial jurisdiction.
What were the conversations that were happening at the center as you all waited for this decision from 2014 to now in 2021?
I really can't say again, unfortunately, because I'm not the person who has spearheaded the court case, which is Dalia Torkey. And the person who launched the court case was Gabrielle Bouchard. So these are like the two folks, and especially during the times in which we went into the trial. It's really Dalia Torkey. She was the one who was putting in the work. She was one who was speaking with interveners, in which the interveners of our case includes EGAL Canada, LGBTQ Family Coalition, and Gender Creative Kids. She was the one who was working with our interveners. She was the one who was speaking with our lawyers, Audrey and Francois. She was the one who was speaking with our co-plaintiffs, Samuel Singer, Sarah Lumel, Abby Heller, and Jenna Jacobs. That's all her. I really want to emphasize that. So my response is going to be thus really limited, because I really want to honor and respect the fact that, she was the one who was doing that work. So I really want to highlight that. So in terms of from the things that I've seen from my perspective and what I've witnessed as the peer support drop-in coordinator, is that there was a lot of delegation that we had to do in the sense of planning out week by week the trial hearing. So when we had our hearings, ensuring that there were peer support volunteers to provide active listening, to ensure that there was enough staff present, ensuring that the appropriate experts were present, following up with experts and witnesses, also rallying the community to attend the court hearings as well, which was definitely very challenging to hear the defense present very dehumanizing quote unquote evidence. I would say that's kind of what it looked like during pre the court case actually happening. It was a lot of Dalia doing that work of connecting with the community and different interveners and organizations, as well as our co-plaintiffs and our witnesses as well. It's really her. I want to just emphasize that tremendously.
Could you explain a little bit about the decision that you got in January, and did anything surprise you?
We were really happy to have received the decision, we waited a long time. We first had the trial in 2019, and then we only received the decision in January 2021. So it was a long, anxious year and some change of anxiety and just waiting for a long time, because there were so many, people who are directly impacted by the results and, the judgment. It is a 58-page document, so we had to wait for our lawyers to you know, unpack that information. And we're still unpacking that information because it is so much. It's 58 pages. But from that, what we were able to gather, and what we also know for sure, is that the judge, Justice Gregory Moore, he rendered many things unconstitutional, such as the requirement that people could only be designated as either male or female, as well as the fact that trans parents are unable to change their parental role from mother, father, or parent on their children's birth certificates, as well as the requirement for trans youth to seek medical evaluations, to receive sex and or name changes, as well as the requirement of Canadian citizenship to change one's name and sex designation. Yeah, those are the first things that we saw that we won, which was really exciting. And the things that we were surprised about was we were actually surprised that we didn't was able to win the parental veto objection. We really wanted to remove and the quote-unquote right given to parents to deny their children's applications, because we had presented not only expert knowledge but also the lived experiences of trans and non-binary individuals who have been directly impacted by set requirement, you know, by set veto given to parents. So that was definitely devastating and also surprising, because we felt very confident in the information presented. And most importantly, we just thought it was shocking given, you know, the fact that they removed one gatekeeper, which are, you know, the medical evaluation from mental health practitioners, but yet, you know, another gatekeeper remains, which is parents. You know, not only is one living at home, potentially living at home with a transphobic parent, but then, you know, in order to, you know, potentially leave the house, you know, which requires getting a job and these different things, or even just trying to apply, you know, for assistance, that process in and of itself can be triggering if one is not able to, you know, put the name and sex designation that is theirs. So that thus then puts youth at risk for homelessness, which is again why we were really surprised and shocked by, you know, this very contradicting result. And we were also shockingly very shocked by the fact that the requirement for sex designation is still required, given the extensive evidence presented about the harmful and forceful interventions done on intersex children at early ages. Upholding that requirement really erased the experiences of intersex individuals across Quebec.
What are some of the concrete things that changed from the day this decision was published?
So the Quebec government has until December 31st, 2021, to implement these changes to the Quebec Civil Code. The centre will be observing and watching the Quebec Civil Code to verify that these changes will be made, and we'll be updating the community through our website and Facebook as we observe the changes. So in terms of has anything been like the material changes, it's still new because, you know, they have until technically December 31st, 2021 to implement that. But what it would look like when they occur is that people can change their sex designation to male, female, or X, and they would also, parents would also be able to change their parental role on their children's birth certificates. Trans migrants will also be able to change their name and sex designation. And all of these various things will have both social, financial, legal, as well as interpersonal implications to individuals living across Quebec.
What are some of the emotions that you're feeling, that the center is feeling, that you're seeing? Broadly speaking, this is a huge historic landmark to change parts of the provincial civil code.
For me, it was really definitely emotional. It was a multitude of emotions, happiness, relief, but also, grief as well, because of the two points that we lost. As I mentioned, it was such a contradictory blow that it was, it was a mixture of emotions. I couldn't say that I felt any, solely happy or solely upset. It was definitely a mixture of things because of the nature of the judgment. But I was also thinking about individuals who would directly be impacted by this. I was thinking about all the trans, non-binary, and intersex migrants that frequently come to the center, that frequently message us about pathways into changing their name and sex designation. I was also thinking about trans parents being able to have their family recognized on a legal but also interpersonal level. These things can pop up in the very smallest ways through, accessing daycare and accessing care, going to the hospital for your child. There's so many different implications in which, one's privacy and safety, and also just sense of being recognized would be impacted. So, I also started thinking about trans youth who, now won't have to, receive medical evaluation, which is also financially a burden for many. But then also thinking about the fact that they're, the parental veto is still upheld, and also just thinking about how this unstable position they're now left in, where it's like, okay, medical evaluations are no longer available, but my parent can still object, so I was also thinking about that as well. And I was also thinking about intersex folks and just how the upholding sex designation just completely erases their experiences, the ongoing historical structurally enforced surgeries that are implemented on intersex folks. Those were all of the things that I was thinking about when we received the decision.
Is there anything else that, is there anyone else that was part of this work that you wanted to mention?
Our co-plaintiffs are Samuel Singer, Sarah Blumel, Abby Heller, and Jenna Jacobs. Our interveners are EGAL Canada, LGBT Family Coalition, and Gender Creative Kids. Also would like to thank our witnesses, our testifiers, all those folks who attended our trials, our peer support volunteers who were able to offer support, all the experts who were able to offer their knowledge, all individuals who are directly impacted, our trans, our non-binary, our intersex folks living in Quebec currently, also through their very existence, supporting us in this court case, the legacy of the activism of trans women of color, the ongoing legacy and activism of trans women of color, that spans and dates back since time. And also thinking about the trans organizations that are for and by trans folks such as Aztec. I'm thinking about so many different folks in this, and of course also to thinking about the Concordia student body who volunteers, funds, and supports the Center for Gender Advocacy as well. And of course, as I mentioned, thank you so much for Gabrielle Bouchard for launching this court case, and Dahlia Torkey for spearheading the trial hearings. None of this would have been possible if it wasn't for them.
And my last question is, how is the center doing and how are you doing during COVID times?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in the COVID context, all of our things are online. We shifted to an online context and platform the moment COVID-19 hit. So we're doing programming online. So for instance, we had our October 4th vigil for missing Indigenous women, girls, Two-Spirit, and Indigenous. People via Zoom, in which people could register for free, confidential peer support every Wednesdays from 3 to 5 p.m. Mondays and Wednesdays, sorry, from 3 to 5 p.m. And there is a possibility to set up an appointment if this time doesn't work for you. Just visit our website at genderadvocacy.org. And we've been pretty much just trying to now that the court cases settled down, we are no longer open to the public, but we are still offering resources which you can find on our website. And we are also offering peer support online still. What we're currently doing is focusing on visioning and bettering our strategies and ways of collaborating with the community, with various communities, I should say. So yeah, that's currently where we're at this present time. We are closed to the public from February 1st until May 10th, 2021. But again, we're still offering resources, which you can find on our website. And we're also offering peer support every Mondays and Wednesdays from 3 to 5 p.m., in which you can register for this on our website at genderadvocacy.org. So yeah, that's it.
That was Jada Joseph with the Center for Gender Advocacy. If you want to know more about the work that they do or the decision that was passed down at the end of the month, you can visit them online at genderadvocacy.org. I'm Sarah Jesmer, and you're listening to CKUT.
1, 2, 3.
Esto es únicamente una prueba. 1, 2, 1, 2.
In Montreal.
CKUT. All the rhythms, all the music, all the time.
90.3 FM.
That was a rerun of a February 2021 interview with the Center for Gender Advocacy. We're listening to it again because in the months that followed this case, the center says that the newly proposed Bill 2 on the provincial level is directly linked as a retaliation following this case. They say while there are positive parts of Quebec's family law reforms, Bill 2 marks some of the most transphobic proposals in Quebec. You can find out more about the center's reaction to Bill 2 on their website, and they're also open for their regular drop-in hours for support.
Hello, dear listeners. As of March 16th, CKUT Studios will be closed until further notice. The programming on our airwaves will consist of a mixture of recent CKUT archives, new pre-recorded segments, and other relevant special programming. Our upcoming funding drive will be postponed until further notice. Thank you for understanding that we are taking these measures to protect the health of our staff and community members. Love, CKUT.
And for the rest of the hour, we're going to share the air with podcasters from Embers. This is their October 28th episode about Fairy Creek. Stay with us till the top of the hour for Montreal news that you can use.
Welcome to the Victoria Anarchist Book Fair's week of podcasts, featuring local, national, and international activists and authors. Due to the ongoing global pandemic, the Book Fair Collective decided to move their event online again this year. So for the second year in a row, From Embers is teaming up with the Victoria Anarchist Book Fair to release presentations over our podcast platform. Recordings of these voices of resistance were conducted on unceded Indigenous territories across so-called British Columbia and beyond. For more information about the book fair and a full schedule of online events this week, check out victoriaanarchistbookfair.ca. And listeners in the Victoria area are encouraged to visit Camus Books at 2620 Quadra Street or online at camus.ca for anarchist publications and more. And to find out more about our regular anarchist podcast, go to fromembers.libsyn.com or simply search From Embers in your favorite podcast app.
The Victoria Anarchist Book Fair Collective would like to acknowledge the interview you are about to hear took place on unceded Wasanich and Lekwungen territories of so-called Victoria, BC, and on the traditional territories of the Lilwat, Chianu, Cowichan, and Chimanis First Nations. My name is Frond. I'm lucky to have interviewed five blockaders, Arvind Singh, Strawberry, Driftwood, Bozo Sapien, and Holly, who make it their business to occupy logging roads in defense of the ancient coastal rainforest ecosystem on the invitation of Pachidot Elder Bill Jones. At the time of this recording, it's day 424 of continuous direct action on Pachidot and Didadot territory, with a total of 1,108 arrests. Thank you all for listening, and please enjoy the interviews.
I'm Arvind Singh. I'm a freelance photographer and videographer based out of Victoria, specifically Machozen on unceded Chianu First Nation Beecher Bay territories. Moved to Canada about 2 years ago. I'm Indian, or I'm mostly Indian, and my mom lives in India now. I grew up in Southeast Asia. I connected to the blockades last summer pretty much because I was really interested in taking a epic shot of Big Lonely Doug. And I went to a tree climbing workshop. And from that tree climbing workshop around August, a couple of folks went and started the blockades. I wasn't one of them, but I had some hesitations around First Nations consent and stuff like that. And when I figured out some things, I started going to the blockades.
Do you remember the month that you started going to the blockades?
Yeah, it was pretty early on. Might be like late August.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that would have been like the founding of River Camp, and people were probably just thinking about what to do for winter. And
I wasn't involved enough to know about like all those things. My contributions were mostly just going and taking firewood and chocolate. I remember asking, "Hey, what do you guys need?" And Shambu had said, "Chocolate and firewood." So I would go up on the weekends and just take chocolate and firewood.
And you're saying that you felt like a kind of a peripheral member of this operation?
Totally. So I wasn't really, I would go up and it would just be mostly hanging out. Like there was a lot of music, campfire, singing, and just enjoying time out there and connecting with the people and feeling like, you know, let's support this in a little way, however we can. And that was pretty much the pattern up until KQ started.
Do you want to describe a little bit what KQ's is?
Oh, yeah. So most of those camps, right, like Waterfall Ridge, HQ, River, they're all protecting this one specific watershed, Adaites on Pachidot territories. KQ's is about, I would guess, 2.5 hours away on Didadot territories. It felt really remote and small compared to Ferry Creek. There was a whole kind of like production at Ferry Creek, right? Like so many people. By the time we were going to KQ's, you know, in February or March, I can't remember exactly. But by the time we were going up there, Ferry Creek had become this big thing. And I would go there with MJ, my wife, and my puppy Denali. And we wouldn't really find like a use, you know? This was before enforcement started. And there wasn't really much for us to do. But at KQ's, we were like, okay, we could be useful here. So it was a much smaller community. And there was still a lot of work to be done when we started putting down roots. There was like, you know, a lot of building and a lot of different scheming and frontline roles. Anything that was exciting and cool, like I was like, okay, let me, you know, let's film this with the consent of the people involved. But like the day I met you, I was filming the extraction of the cookie.
That's right.
You know, the 2-ton, 800-year-old slice of a fir from a stump that had been cut down previously. And that was a big production. That was pretty exceptional to be a part, to see. You know, a lot of ingenuity and also a lot of risk, like personal risk, to harvest this slice and transport it using the bare minimum of equipment, right? Like in India, we have this saying called Jugaad, which is like doing something with like just improvising with the bare minimum of equipment, like turning a scooter into something that can crush your wheat. Mill, just jerry rigging it up in your, I think in Canada there's a phrase similar, like MacGyvering things.
That's right.
So I basically was quite exciting to just see this MacGyvering of this thing, so we could transport this cookie to the bridge. And I was filming that.
So were you there when police enforcement began?
Yeah. So we spent, you know, I remember that morning, my wife had been the LO and the DLTs had visited, and they had been coming pretty regularly. And they had said, hey, you guys have 24 hours. And tomorrow at 8 a.m., the police come in and they're going to go through this camp and anybody here will be arrested. And we had been preparing for this, right? And the week before had been so full of anticipation that this wasn't a surprise, but it was like finally like, okay, like now these muscles that have been trained can actually start moving. And yet still, there was like also a little bit of a crisis, because things like the Starlink had to be set up in the back with power, you know, battery packs, and it was raining horribly. And I remember that day just getting absolutely drenched and just freezing my ass off and getting like 2 hours of sleep, being out there through the night kind of thing, like everybody was. I think there were so many people just who got soaked doing things. And then when the police rolled in, MJ and I, we started driving out. So as the cops were coming in, we were driving out, and it was just this like really heart-wrenching thing, because we weren't planning to be arrested. We were pretty much evacuating while leaving our friends behind. And we were part of this convoy. And it was so surreal leaving behind this place and just having, you know, police take down our name and our number and our car license. And it really felt like, oh my God, we'll never be able to go back, because, you know, they know everything. And it was just a bit scary and sad. But, you know, within 2 days I was back there, and that chapter dragged on for quite a bit of time. But I remember, you know, really viscerally, the day enforcement started, and all the people who had come to camp to support, people who had never been there, but just like overnight we had like 15 or 20 new people ready to chain themselves into gates and dragons and things.
And so you said you came back, right? Do you want to talk about like what you witnessed when you came back?
Sure. So I came back because I was on assignment with the PBS documentary. So I had legitimate grounds to be there. And the RCMP at that point weren't being shits about media access. So we went in. They still had those ridiculous exclusion zones, right? But what would happen was you would meet up at a point somewhere near Honeymoon Bay or something. And then you would convoy in with the MRO and you would be escorted into Kekus. And that was very surreal, driving into Kekus as part of this big convoy. And at some point, you know, the cars would all park on the side of the road and there'd be some bureaucratic thing that the cops had to go through amongst themselves. And then the helicopter would just land like 100 or 50 feet. Or, you know, I was in a car that was pretty close to what they were using as a heli landing site. And then to see, you know, that level of enforcement, I was like, wow, wait, what is going on? You know, there's a helicopter. That was not something I had anticipated to see. Oh, I hadn't thought about, but it was jarring to see it. It was land, you know, it was so close. And a lot of the trucks, the RCMP trucks, when they opened the doors, you would be able to see they had assault rifles perched between the two front drivers, people in the cab. And, you know, it was just it was a bit of a jarring feeling, like, because we had all talked about what enforcement would look like. And in our heads, it was maybe some naivety, but there was it was going to be a kind of a co-production of a theatrical performance that would, you know, we would broadcast around the world to draw attention to this thing. That's kind of how people conceived it, and the prospect of helicopters and assault rifles, that didn't fit with that vision. And so we drove in, and it was still not violent up at that point. We got in, and there was an exclusion zone, but you could see what was going on, even if it was like 100 or 200 meters away. In one case, it was 200 meters away. But they were pretty strict about keeping the media away from the enforcement area. And there was a little bit of camaraderie amongst the photographers and the media people there. There was already, even at that point, like day one or day two, I think this is day two, a split between mainstream and the independent media. I remember, you know, being pretty disappointed. At one point, there was the MRO, you know, there was a person being extracted at a distance, like 200 meters away. And all the independent, like myself and a few of the independents were like, hey, we want to hear what they have to say. You know, we want to record it and film it. And we had a little bit of a satellite thing to live stream it. And the mainstream media just were not bothered. And, you know, CBC, Czech, CTV, these folks, they all lined up their cameras on tripods and they just interviewed the MRO who made a statement and then they left. And they asked permission to leave early because they had kind of got their story and they were like, you know, they had a long day ahead and they just wanted to go. And so they had to actually be escorted out earlier than planned. The RCMP were like, oh, you want to leave early? Okay, we'll make it happen. And they just got escorted out. Whereas the rest of us were just kind of out there being like, hey, this is ridiculous. We want to actually interview the person who's being extracted. And so that was the pattern. It was pretty frustrating. It was like a stage managed access. So you could only see, you know, limited things. And there was a sense that whenever there was a high risk extraction, like the person might have got hurt. And touch wood, at that point, anybody did at Keikus. But if there had been a risk of that, then certainly they wouldn't have allowed cameras during the process. And that's what it felt like. Like anything that was important to film, we weren't allowed to film.
Well, my name is Cheyenne. My camp name is Strawberry. I'm an Afro-Indigenous land defender. I've been out at Fairy Creek. I was out at Fairy Creek for, over 4 months full time. I didn't leave. I think I went for a couple supply runs, but it's usually for camp. So, and it's quite a bit of a mission to get over from Fairy Creek to here. So yeah, I lived out there. This is my first time back at my house.
Wow.
Sleeping in a bed and being in a house for a long time.
I'm curious, which of the blockades was the one that you started at?
I actually just started at HQ. I came in and I spent some time at HQ and just trying to get situated. So I kind of have like a bit of a different story. Over the last 3 years, I've been, I've had a neurological disease. So it affects kind of like my mobility and my speech. I couldn't talk for like 10 months.
Hmm.
And then, so when I came to Fairy Creek, I have a lot of mobility issues. So I've been kind of in and out of a wheelchair and walker for the last couple of years, so kind of progressing. And so when I got to Fairy Creek, I didn't know how I was going to support being in my state and what I could do, but I kind of felt the need to go. I left kind of like the day after the Kamloops children were found at the residential school there. So,
oh wow.
Yeah. So just because of my family and the way that we've been impacted by colonialism, it felt, wanted to be there for a long time at Fairy Creek, and also wanted to go up to Wet'suwet'en, but due to the state of my health, I wasn't able to leave. And so I just kind of got up one day and left. And when I got to Fairy Creek, I didn't know like how I would fit in or like what my role would be or what it even looked like really to be there, because like, you know, social media doesn't really talk about camp life. It doesn't talk about day to day and what that looks like there. And so when I got to HQ, it was just kind of more trying to get acquainted with like what Fairy Creek was, what it looked like, trying to figure out what my how it was going to get around from A to B. So that's kind of where I spent my time. And then I ended up leaving from there and going up to River. And I spent, over 3 months up at River.
Wow.
All over. I mean, I've spent lots of time up at Waterfall, but supporting as many places as I can. But like, I would say my home base was River.
Right.
At a permanent location.
Yeah. Yeah. River's a good place. What is an example of something, that represents camp life that the social media presence doesn't really communicate?
Yeah. I would say like the things that I don't see on social media are like how every day, like there's just like these group of amazing humans that like get together and they pool all of their resources. Like people are so resourceful at Prairie Creek, and everybody, you know, the people I've met are coming from all different walks of life and they're all bringing something different. Yeah. And so I think that is just something that blew me away, was just seeing how every day people are showing up to fight for this cause. But it was more of a cause, instead of being in this colonial world where we're just like working and operating and being on these schedules, just seeing people showing up and volunteering and using their time. But people, yeah, the way that people communicate and the way that people come together is different than when we're out in the colonial world, when we have to work and we have to show up, we have to do these things. It's like this, it's a different force behind it, where like at Fairy Creek, it's like we want to be there. We're like there for the trees, the ecosystem, for land back. We're fighting for, you know, indigenous sovereignty and all of the things. But, you know, at home, it's a different situation. And out there, everybody's, you know, when we volunteer for our jobs every day, we, you know, we sign up, we do the things, and it's a different, you know, we take respite. My friends are always ensuring, like, are you, you know, have you taken care of yourself? Do you need anything? And just like this solid community of people checking in. And as I mentioned, my health issues. And so having people just seeing I'm not feeling well, like bringing me food to my tent, and just seeing the kindness and the compassion that people have for each other, and how hard everybody works, and music and creativity and yeah, and the arts and all of the things that, you know, also like I came to Fairy Creek within 3 days of being there. People are like, I kind of voiced it was hard to get to a bathroom. So like within like a couple of days of being there, an accessible bathroom was built for me at HQ. And then it was, you know, here, you need a handicap parking spot by the kitchen. They made me my own spot. And
right.
You know, the things that we don't really hear about, you know, and that means a lot, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, for a voice to be heard and for a reaction to be so fast. I mean, like that, yeah, that's not something that society here, so-called Victoria, that's not something that this place is really set up to have. Yeah.
Right. It's the same thing here. Ableism. And yeah. And people don't think about these things. But, yeah.
Were you present at all while Waterfall was defending itself against industry and RCMP?
Yep. Definitely. I spent some time up at Waterfall. When I came in, I had a friend, a really kind, compassionate friend that helped me get into Waterfall. So we hiked in and I spent lots of time up there supporting. I also was locked into a dragon and arrested up there. We had, you know, many people supporting us while we were there, bringing us food, making sure we were comfortable. And then when enforcement finally arrived, we were met with some pretty like this crew that and enforcement was pretty, I would say they were pretty violent. And so when we were getting extracted at the last second, one of our friends jumped on top of the log that we were on. So he ended up walking in at the last second. And so we ended up having an extra person, and just the way that our enforcement came up and just started. So the first person they went for was my friend that was on top of the log. They just violently kind of like ripped him off. And then they kind of came for me next. And so I'm 5'5". I weigh like 120, 125 pounds. I'm fairly small. And with enforcement kind of like trying to like rip me out, I was, you know, had my bracelet around my wrist. And so they kept trying to pull me out. And then they kind of threw me back on my back. And I remember just trying to kind of go back and kind of curl up, and then them throwing me back. And then I had 5 enforcement officers. I had one crushing my chest. I had a knee in my chest, a knee in my stomach, and then 3 knees on my leg. And I remember yelling for them to get off because I couldn't breathe. And
wow.
Yeah, like there may have been another BIPOC person in the flower behind, but in that immediate area was the only BIPOC person. And so I just remember my friends yelling, my 2 friends who are white identifying, yelling at the cops to get off of me and get off. And yeah, so it ended up kind of being a bit of a violent way for them to kind of get me into handcuffs. It felt very violating and super unnecessary. I mean, I'm 5 feet. It does not take like 5 grown male officers.
I'm sorry to hear that, like, it was so targeted. That's something that we hear a lot about the RCMP's behavior. You know, Waterfall, like, may have been this strategic position. When I was there this time last year, and it was more about, like, making sure there were enough people to actually be there.
Yeah.
To like protect the totes, you know, like there'd be like totes yes. crackers in them or something. And we just needed to make sure that there were enough people there. But maybe I'm curious to hear your perspective, why Waterfall became such a, in some sense, it became like symbolic.
Oh yeah. 100%. So yeah, like for me, when I think about Waterfall, like I think about a couple different things. Like I think about a location that enforcement was never able to take. They were never able and still have not taken Waterfall. We have lost all protection camps and still Waterfall is still standing. So for me, like, it's just like when I think about Waterfall, I just think about like the power and like the power of the people and like how it never stopped and it didn't matter. Like, I remember the first time I got to Waterfall, I was just like in awe because it's like we hiked in and come into the Screech kitchen and just like it was a beautiful huge kitchen and everybody's working and then like looking around trying to figure it out and all you can hear are people working. It's just like, you know, people digging and like building and it doesn't stop. It goes all day, it goes all night, and there's people cooking all day and all night to ensure that these hardworking people are fed with all this like super nutritious food, but made with love. Like, people are literally pouring everything into this, like everything. There's just something so beautiful and compassionate. Like, just, it is iconic because of that, and it's never been taken.
Music. That was an excerpt of an October 28th episode created by From Embers about Fairy Creek. If you want to hear the rest, you can head to fromembers.libsyn.com.
What? My radio stuck on CKUT. I don't know. But nah, fix it. CKUT, the number 1 radio station in Montreal. We give you the sun, the moon, the rain, the stars and the mountain. CKUT give you the word.
And before you go, here's some news that you can use. The local chapter of Canadian Italians Against Oppression is organizing an anti-femicide walk in honor of Romain Bonnier. Bonnier was recently murdered by her ex-partner in broad daylight earlier this month. Her death marks the 17th femicide in Quebec this year. The march starts at Face High School at 12:30 p.m. on Saturday. And the group Solidarity Across Borders is organizing a rally in front of mayoral candidate Denis Coderre's office this weekend. They want Montreal to become a solidarity city to legalize all non-status people. The rally is at 11 a.m. on Sunday, October 31st. And the 24/7 shelter Hotel Du is requesting donations of bras, sweaters, and winter coats. You can drop these off at Hotel Du Complex on St. Urbain, preferably between 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. on weekdays. They're just one organization in Montreal, starting their collections of winter clothing. And the McGill Drama Festival is collecting for original scripts until midnight of November 8th. And the Players Theater will put on selected plays on McGill's campus in 2022, and the first place submission will receive a monetary prize. You can find more information by searching for McGill Drama Festival. And that concludes this Friday's edition of Off the Hour, produced by Montreal's Community News Collective. The collective includes Brian Jefferson, Alice Wu, Kate Addison, Joel Somadal, and Sarah Jesmer. For more information on anything you heard tonight, or if you would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 7000, or newsintern at ckut.ca. Also, you can follow us on...
Ciao a tutti, sono Antonio Tessitore da Rai Radio 3 a Roma. Ascoltate CKUT. Listen to CKUT on 90.3 FM.
CKUT 90.3 FM is proud to rebroadcast the following program entirely in the Mohawk language. The Mohawk, or Ganyatgahaga, are the original people of the unceded traditional territory known as Montreal, or Chojaake. The Ganyatgahaga, or people of the Flint, have two communities close by, and they are working hard at revitalizing their language. This program is part of those efforts, and it originally aired in Ganasadage on RKR Reviving Ganasadage Radio. And now, listen to Chojaake's indigenous language on CKUT. What